you're talking about someone who killed 3,000 Americans quite deliberately. Never mind the coal, never mind the bombings in East Africa, never mind the problems that he's stirring up around the world. What a lovely intellectual thought that that we would leave him untouched and unharmed to wander around the world. So forgive me, I just find the remark somewhat amazing and frankly, ill-considered.
And I agree, it is stunning. Now, Buzzy Krongard, his philosophy is the reason, as he says, that keep this guy in place is that there'll be so many others, sort of these top lieutenants vying for the spot, sort of creating maybe horrific attacks, trying to vie for position. Is there any logic to that?
Well, I think there's certainly been some concern what would happen if we either captured or killed him and what the reactions to that would be. That's an inevitable part of any kind of war you have on terrorism. But you're really talking about someone who's a tremendous symbol here. If he were killed or captured by the United States, that would send a message, I think, fairly clearly to all these groups around the world that we mean business. And these people really understand that in those terms. So to suggest somehow we would leave him wandering around to be challenged by younger bucks, I just find that incredible.
Are we better off killing him or capturing him, in your opinion?
Capturing, by far.
I think to get information.
Well, a combination of information, but also a combination of public relations. I think the pictures of Saddam Hussein, for instance, after he was captured, showing him as what he was, which is sort of a tired old man looking fairly strong.
The hell up, Ron Marks. This nonsense about you're talking about someone who would kill 3,000 people in America. Look, Osama would kill 3,000 more people in America at Sam's order at best. And then, would be out of the loop completely at worst. Then you say it's better off killing or capturing Osama. Look, you better hope that no one captures Boy George the way things are going nowadays. And then second, you need Bin Laden as much as he needs you. It's two right-wing pro-private market slavers from a slaver societies who justify it through Christianity, and the other through Islam. You know what time it is, slave time, check it out. You're listening to 104.1, 101.1 Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois, LUVER.com, the world, and radioforall.net, the universe, slave revolt time. Tonight, we're going to shoot our way into a Beyond the Shadow segment, as we're going to deal with the propaganda machine throughout Hollywood in a movie called Rules of Engagement. Really, it's rules of propaganda. So you got all that in a hell of a lot more 104.1. Slave revolt.
Seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You see, where they've gone, they're playing with the universe. They're playing with the solar system. But they have no perception and no way to measure what the amount of energy that's going to flow out from that light off
You know what time it is now. Beyond the Shadow. And what we're going to deal with tonight is the rules of propaganda. In other words, recently, when issues of the American atrocities hit more or less the airwaves, what then starts to take place is often spun as an abnormality. This gets into the role of Hollywood in its myth-making games. There's a movie out not too long ago called Rules of Engagement. It stars Samuel Jackson as Colonel Terry Childress and Tommy Lee Jones as a partner of his in the Marines who has retired. Both of them served time in Nam, and you see some of the early action of their experiences in Nam. The Tommy Lee Jones character is basically about to retire, and Samuel Jackson's character, Childress, continues on with his military career, you know, Gulf Wars, Panama, on up until today. We're going to start and examine this particular movie and how things are played out in the world of Hollywood. And the part we're going to take it is Jackson, i.e. Childress, Colonel Childress of the Marine Corps, is informed that in the country of Yemen, there's an outbreak at the U.S. Embassy. And at that point, Jackson and company decide they need to take back the U.S. Embassy and escort out some of the American people who are in the embassy, like the U.S. ambassador and his family. So let's follow it step by step and mix it in with the real world, and we'll take it from there. Check it out.
Terry, we've been ordered to the Arabian Sea, Gulf of Aden. This comes straight down 2nd Division through General Perry. The American Embassy at Yemen is surrounded by a crowd of demonstrators. Crowded and hostile, but it's large enough to spook their government into pulling their security forces. 24th Marine Expeditionary Unit's going to provide extra security. We're going to babysit, Colonel.
Roger that.
Just show our presence. Remember, though, if it turns hot, we're looking at an evac. We've got an ambassador and his family there. Now, let me run you through this. Here's your potential LZs. Marines at the embassy advise we can gain entrance through the back way. Here's some stairs here where you can deploy your men to the roof, and these are your overwatch positions.
I'll take them in myself, quietly. One platoon, trap team, put everyone else on ready fire.
My thoughts exactly, Colonel.
Engage! Open fire!
All right, what you saw or heard in part take place was Samuel Jackson and the Marines take back the U.S. Embassy. Actually, there wasn't really nothing to take back. They go into the embassy and clear it out of American citizens. But then there's a lot of sniper fire by the, various Yemen rebel movements, so on and so forth. But at the same time, there's a lot of protesters. Now, right there is kind of a stereotype because you see all of these protesters, men, women, kids, and the Marines who went up on the roof. They got there by the helicopter on top of the U.S. Embassy in Yemen. They're engaging with these shooters, rebel shooters, who are basically like a building away. Yet down below, you have massive scores of Yemenese people who are protesting the U.S. being there or whatever. They never really distinguish what's going on with that. But it's clear they're right in the crossfire, yet they don't try to get out of the way or say, let's protest another day. They're going to keep protesting with bullets flying right over their head. So it's kind of this little stereotype thing. But then what ends up happening is Jackson and his Marines are taking some casualties. And Jackson's interpretation is that not only is some of the bullets coming from across the buildings where the rebel fighters are, but there are people down in the crowd. So that's when he tells Blair Underwood, who plays another Marine, to order the Marines to start firing in the crowd. So that's when you... heard Jackson say, go ahead, da 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 da. And then you hear this machine gun blast, and then there's quiet afterwards. And that's basically because, as a result, there's 83 Yemenese people laying dead on the ground, and all of the other fighting stops at that particular point. Now, this is just the beginning of the Hollywood fiction that starts to take place in this movie. Now, actually, when I say fiction, it's not that the U.S. G.I. Joes have not been shooting in the crowds everywhere they've gone, from Panama throughout the Middle East to Africa. It's just, let's take it to the next step. Next, as this thing plays out in Hollywood land, the National Security Advisor has a meeting with other Pentagon members and heads of state about what their position is going to be about Childress, i.e. Sam Jackson, ordering the shooting of the people down below, where Jackson also says there was... they were receiving a lot of heavy gunfire. So let's see how these guys take this issue on. Check it out.
The FBI investigation shows that all the bullet holes in the embassy wall came from directly across the way, the snipers.
Any weapons or ammo found among the dead or wounded?
No, sir. Nothing. However, intelligence suggests this could have been a terrorist operation.
Any proof?
This is a tape from the embassy security system. I'm going to thread it up.
No, I don't want to watch videos, and I don't want to hear about ammo casings in some building, because here I got 83 dead people. Unarmed. Women, children, old men. Another 100 or so critically wounded. Here I've got an international crisis of mega fucking proportions.
Bill, you know that there have been regular reports of a terrorist plot against this embassy.
This was a regularly scheduled protest. It was every week. Like clockwork's the usual bullshit about American presence in the Gulf. Have you looked at these? I mean, I'm just assuming you have, since they're on the front page of every newspaper in the world. It's not that the rest of the world wants to hold us responsible. We are responsible. We can't even have the appearance of a cover-up.
That does not excuse us from our duty, Mr. Sokol. We sent Colonel Childers in there, and the mission went to shit. Now, we can't go after the man who carried out his orders and ignore the people who issued those orders.
Childers ordered the slaughter of innocent women and children. Let's just get that straight right now.
I'll tell you what we ought to get straight. We lost 3 United States Marines.
They lost 83! Now, are we going to go to war with Yemen over it? We're covering our ass all over the Middle East right now, General. Because of your man's hot-headed miscalculation, we are in danger of losing our embassies in Saudi, Jordan, and Egypt. We're in danger of losing our presence with every moderate in the region. Now they're going to scream cover-up. And the screaming is going to get so loud, we'll be sending Marines back over there. And when that happens, the body count of American dead is going to be a hell of a lot higher than 3.
I see where you're going with this, Mr. Sobel. Now, you be needing me more today?
No. No, that's fine, General. Thank you.
Good day to you, sir.
Where do you think you're going with that?
You don't want to look at it.
Nobody's looking at it. Why should the United States be held responsible for the actions of one man?
What if the crowd had weapons? What if this shows they did fire first?
He could have fired over their heads, this moron! Didn't he know where he was? The Middle East! You know, he could have isolated on the snipers. He could have avoided confrontation. He could have done 50 fucking things. Instead, he destroyed a fragile trust. He put his own men in danger. Fuck this guy. Forget this tape. I don't want to watch it. I don't want to testify about it. I don't want it to exist.
Okay, that tape they were talking about was they had video cameras up at the embassy. And in the tape, you actually see Arab insurgents shooting up at the little Marines. Now, we know in the real world, if the Pentagon had evidence that they were getting and taking, their Marines were taking fire from the insurgents, they would blast that out all over the world. They'd be running it out through all corners of the network, and all of the corporate media would be blasting it out. Yet, here, under this kind of puritanical imagery stuff of America, this national security advisor has decided that Jackson has acted inappropriately, so he's just going to have to take the fall because other repercussions. Now, what's also corny about it, again, is that, like I said, if you had people shooting over the heads of protesters and another extremely armed insurgent group, i.e. the U.S. Marines, shooting back, common sense would tell you that people have common sense in the world and they get the hell out of there. They're right in the crossfire. But in this stereotypical Hollywood world, the mothers weren't concerned about their kids protesting. The kids weren't concerned about their grandfathers and fathers protesting. No, they were all a bunch of angry Arabs, and common sense gets kicked to the curb. So they stand there in the middle of this crossfire. But when you see the videotape that the National Security Advisor does not want to exist and later burns up in a fireplace, you see that there's much shooting even coming from the protesters. In other words, basically there were these insurgents hiding as protesters in the crowd and shooting. Now, if anything people throughout the world have learned is that if there's Marines around and you don't have a gun and they're looking like they're about ready to start shooting, you best get the hell out the way. Because they consistently shoot up populations all the time that are unarmed. Any excuse that they can think of, they blast people. They talked openly about blasting all types of little kids in Somalia who didn't have guns, but you know, just happened to be around when they were just waging hellfire. We know of the collateral damage type of things that they would engage in, from Somalia to Iraq to Panama, went after so-called top officials and or leaders and stuff. So to hear in this Hollywood version of the world about nobody's looking at this video, I don't care about this video, and on, shows and gives an indication on where this movie is already headed in its propagandistic mechanisms.
Yeah, also, to be perfectly frank, you were quite generous, Trace, when you say that, well, you know, they got the people looking like they angry and not afraid of weapons. Ain't nobody...
I said it was stereotypes.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's right. That's why they got them looking like, you know, this is a fantasy we're talking about. But in fact, it's actually a little uglier than that. They're trying to make it look like Arabs groove on violence. Oh, there's violence? Come on down, man. They got some violence going on. Down there in front of the embassy. Yeah, do it. Ooh.
Well, the way the movie basically portrays it is that they were just impervious to it.
In other words,
you had people who were protesting, and then the insurgents were engaged in, and the people were impervious to it. So they're in the movie, they're in kind of like a hypnotized robotic state, because you don't even see them reacting to the fact that the Marines have come,
shooting with
that the Marines have come,
yeah,
and that the insurgents are engaging the Marines. In other words, they came there hypothetically to protest, you know, whatever at the U.S. embassy, and then
U.S. out. More
and then an engagement started to happen, but they were impervious to it. Now, this is, like I said, helped to stereotype the whole... they were so droned out that you don't even know... Well, I mean, going by the movie, the fact that there was an engagement going on, it was like they were droned out from that action because they were so hypnotized in saying what they have to say. But next, let's go back to the real world for a few minutes. And here's Michael Ratner on the Bush administration's position on laws against torture. Now, we heard how they try to present their Americano Posada in this movie. Let's hear what's really going down in the land of Oz. Check this out.
New report is one, actually, that the center helped surface a couple of days ago and was reported in the Wall Street Journal. It's a report on interrogation techniques by the Working Group on Interrogations. It went apparently all the way up to Rumsfeld. It was co-authored by a variety of lawyers in the intelligence services. It has many remarkable things in it, but the most remarkable, the one that I think has astounded not just lawyers, but the world, are the pages that say the president, as commander-in-chief, can ignore the prohibitions on torture and criminal law simply doesn't apply to him. That in the aid of national security, he can do essentially whatever he wants, and that the Convention Against Torture is essentially a nullity. I mean, people were just stunned by that. It then goes on to say that to protect people who are beneath the president, you know, people who might be interrogators or military intelligence, it might be best to have the president issue a national security directive indicating that this is the position he takes as a way of protecting them. Now, we don't know if that's ever been issued. The annex to the report, which outlines the number of interrogation techniques, we do not have yet. That is still classified. It is a utterly remarkable document that people in this administration, lawyers, could actually write that in this day and age you can ignore really hundreds of years of law against torture. You know, the question is what was the president doing here? This material from the Gonzales counsel to the president, that he was giving memos to the president, to this one, which who knows where this one, and whether the president issued a national security directive. And when Ashcroft was asked about that today in a congressional hearing, he refused to answer whether, to what extent, the president, whether he had issued anything with regard to this, and to what extent, to whether or not the president had seen this. He did say in the end that, well, I'm not aware that the president authorized any torture. Now, that's the second defense. In other words, they have two defenses to the torture. One is that it's simply the president can violate the law. It reminds you of sort of the Pinochet defense in the sense of national security. He can do anything. But that's the defense we've talked about with this memo. The second defense is what we have done in Iraq, what we have done in Guantanamo does not constitute torture. And so they've essentially it's Orwellian because they've redefined the word torture so that it doesn't include things like stress and duress, dogs, stripping, sleep deprivation, and starvation diet. Any lawyer, 99.9% of the lawyers who think about it would all say, and judges would all say that constitutes torture. So that's their two defenses. But in the end, really, they've been caught. They've been caught really engaging in torture, and they've been caught trying to find legal explanations that are so off the wall and so beyond the comprehension of any person who believes in the rule of law and in anything to do with treaties that it's almost beyond belief.
Now, that's the real-world experience of what's going on in Sam's empire. But when you watch this movie with the title Rules of Engagement, that all sets up this whole thing of, like, no man is against the laws. You know, the whole law and order society. So even if you're trying to, quote-unquote, do the right thing for the empire, if you step a little bit out of line, consciously or not... Or do things that are just politically overcharged and putting the U.S. Empire in a bad light. Even though they have proof to exonerate you, you gotta go. Now, this is just a reworking of reality. This is just propaganda because, as you heard Michael Ratner lay out, the depth of barbarity that Sam is consciously willing to break international laws when it concerns war or basically any other thing really knows no bounds. Recently, one of the people that's most likely going to get appointed to take Ashcroft's position is none other than Gonzalez. And he was the one who scripted up much of this jargon that basically tried to outline and exonerate the U.S., the Pentagon, Boy George, being complicit in their redefinition of torture taking place throughout the world. So Gonzalez, unlike the Samuel Jackson character, he's not pinned up to be crucified. As a matter of fact, by this particular administration, he's being rewarded for his international crime and barbarity. And, for the most part, he's had the carpet rolled out by him, for him, by the Democratic Party. That's how it works in the real world, not in a Hollywood make-believe world.
Well, now, let's try to be a little more fair to these sick-ass Democrats, because they are sick. While it's true they're about to give a trimester abortion, they're about to give it up, give that to the Republicans as a so-called compromise, I have heard them actually try to criticize Gonzalez. They've actually said a negative thing or two about this character. But the truth of the matter is...
That may be good for little liberals who are impressed by that and say, you know, let's give it to the Democrats.
He's still there. But that's the point.
Well, they're not developing or strategizing any campaign to stop him. They're not organizing amongst themselves. Or
filibustering and anything else that needs to be done.
Because for the most part, he is the man for the empire. So, I can't...
take that serious, man.
Nah. It's a minstrel show.
You know what? Actually, there is a difference going on here. Now, let's not lose this. While Tracy's contempt for the so-called Democratic Party's oppositional posture is, of course, justifiable. The reality is there is some real opposition, though, that's not. And I'll tell you where it's coming from. It's coming from inside the military because.
That's something different. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, and I wasn't even addressing that, on top of that, there's some opposition in the Republican Party.
Right.
I mean, so that has nothing to do with what we're talking about concerning the Democratic Party.
Right. But the opposition stems from the common sense that if you go around flapping your jap about torture's okay, what's going to happen to the foot soldiers that get captured in any prolonged conflict? Because they will get captured. And we already know. That's why we set up the head coffin business. How are we doing there, by the way?
Excellent. Next, Jackson, i.e. Childress, is immediately charged with murder in the movie. And also, of course, court-martial. And he calls on Tommy Lee Jones, his old lawyer friend. Well, now he's become a lawyer since he was in the Marines and you know, came back from Nam. He's not supposed to be that good of a lawyer. But since Jackson and him go back such a long ways, Jackson taps on Tommy Lee Jones' shoulder, and they get into how the government is setting up the case as Sokol, who is the national security advisor who I mentioned earlier, who was talking about, I don't want anyone seeing this video, the hell with the video, and so on and so forth, get their prosecution team ready to immediately end the career of Samuel Jackson. Check it out.
Thanks a lot. When's the last time you actually caught something here?
2 years.
I really need your help.
Oh, yeah, I'll help. Anything you need. You want me to take the stand? I'll be a character witness. Anything you want.
No, you don't understand what I'm asking. I want you to be my lawyer.
I'm a good enough lawyer to know you need a better lawyer than me. Besides that, I'm short. 2-9 plus one wake up and I'm gone. You need one of those Washington cats.
I don't want some Starbucks drinker who's never seen combat. I need somebody who's been shot at.
Oh, yeah. I've been shot at. That's what I am. A shot up Marine. As a matter of fact, that's all the hell I am. No, wait a minute. I'm also a weak lawyer. I'm a very weak lawyer. And the government is going to come at you with every goddamn thing they've got.
Major Bill Sokol, it's a pleasure to meet you. Let me introduce you. Gentlemen, this is Major Mark Biggs. He'll be prosecuting the Childress court-martial. The Marines put the Major through Stanford Law, and he owes him a couple years before he takes over the rest of the world. Major, of course, you know General Lowry. I'd like you to meet General West, Secretary of Defense, Mr. Wyatt.
Have a seat. Make yourself comfortable.
What I gather from our esteemed NSC advisor and Secretary of State is we've got a trial in 2 weeks. Seems awfully damn fast.
Oh, I believe everyone in this room will agree. It's in the national interest that this trial be moved along quickly.
The Article 32 investigation was complete and comprehensive. It all seems to point in one direction.
Has he got himself a lawyer yet?
Actually, he's requested a military attorney, Sir Colonel Hayes Hodgett. Marine Division Lejeune.
Any relation to General H. Lawrence Hodges?
His son.
Larry Hodges was one of this country's most distinguished officers.
What do we know about Colonel Hayes Hodges?
He's a guy who got blown apart in Vietnam, then went to Georgetown Law and became a cynic. Is that about right, Major?
He was 67th in his class at Georgetown, sir. He doesn't take too many cases, doesn't win too many. He apparently went through an ugly divorce, had a drinking problem, retiring in 2 weeks.
Jesus. Can we guarantee we get this guy?
Sir, if I may say something. I am not a hired gun. I accepted this assignment because I believe in the merits of the government's case. I am not going to stack the deck against this guy. I will try this case on good evidence only.
I'm glad to hear it.
All right. So you hear this little patriotic rhetoric and so on and so forth. But, you know, one of the things that they're trying to do when Tommy Lee and Samuel Jackson are in conversation early on about, you know, look, I'm not that good of a lawyer. I'm just a shot up Marine. And then Jackson says, well, I don't want some kind of Starbucks type of, you know, pencil neck lawyer and all of that. I want someone who's been shot up. This is the Clint Eastwood technique. You know, all of those old Clint Eastwood, Dirty Harry type movies.
Make my day.
Where the whole position was, is that Clint was being held back by the rules and regulations of the system from doing his job the way it needed to be done. If you really needed to deal with these pimps and hustlers and so on and so forth, you needed really just to let Clint loose. And this is something that these bureaucrats this can't and would never understand. This is in part why Jackson went to his old friend Tommy Lee, who was in the combat zone with him back in the Nam days. Now, the other thing that's kind of corny is that you see them talk about how the trial is going to be in 2 weeks. So Samuel Jackson, first, here they have evidence that the way the movie scripted out, that Jackson actually had the right for the rules of engagement against, you know, the population that was down below because of so many of the insurgents that were firing at him. But someone within the, his own governmental ranks, the bureaucrat, is betraying him by not only withholding the evidence, but setting it on fire. But now they want immediate trial on that. So it's a double-pronged persecution of a Samuel Jackson take place. Now think about all of these things that have gone on lately in trials and so-called trials and things that were supposed to be trials and stuff. From Robert Novak leaking out the name of a CIA agent, Valerie Plame, when they were trying to get the former ambassador to Niger, the American ambassador to Niger back for not going along with the script that the U.S. or that Iraq had contacted Niger, country of Niger in Africa, for some uranium. So they destroy his wife's career to get back at him. And Robert Novak, the one who got the call from someone involved in the Pentagon, Carl Rove or one of his little sidekicks, Novak nor anyone within the Pentagon ranks has been under the hot seat since that time. It's been damn near like a year or more. Actually, it's been more than a year since that time. They've been dragging their feet and so on and so forth. But in this movie, boom, 2 weeks. And they pretend like they just go get them, take care of business. So, in other words, once again, it's not rules of engagement. It's rules of propaganda.
Yeah, but I the propaganda got a little heavy when the little prosecutor to be says, well, sir, I believe in this case. And I ain't gonna have to pull no dirty moves to get this bastard. You don't know all that old silly ass comic book yap. Prosecutors use any and every possible dirty trick, short of hand, anything that will win the case. That's what we have seen here. We ain't at war here, right here. That's what they do. That's what they do to the American people here. So you know when they trying to trick the Arab people out their oil, they gonna put on a show. That's what we mean when we say a show trial. Cause that I can tell you right now, that's all these things ever are. They just today convicted one of those, I don't know whether he was a sergeant or who he was, for the Abu Ghraib thing. Today. Now, if you stop and think about it, well, they still doing the same thing they was doing back then now. They ain't stopped torturing them people. They ain't stopped bombing them. They ain't stopped killing them. They still there. Abu Ghraib is still there. And they still doing the same stuff they was doing when they got caught. Because the stupid assholes took pictures of themselves committing these crimes against humanity. So they, all right, but they, didn't they, wait a minute now, didn't they just convict a man today? What am I talking about? That conviction ain't had nothing to do with no justice for no Iraqi people. That was once again, just like this bullshit election, is for the American people. So that y'all out there in Suckerland will mistakenly think that actually Sam ain't all that bad. Why? Didn't they just convict that man for torturing those people? I'm sorry, but that's propaganda. The act of carrying out the trial and then putting it on all the different media outlets for you to hear the justice. Justice has been done. There ain't no damn justice. Justice would have been having his ass tried in Iraq by the people that he persecuted. And whatever was left of him, just sent it on home.
Justice would have gone all the way up the ladder. But that's why the justice has to be done by an indigenous force outside of the spectrum of the ruling class. The whole thing with the whole Abu Ghraib stuff is because they had the pictures. But in this movie, they had the pictures, quote-unquote, to exonerate Samuel Jackson. But they're trying to spin it like they're still going after him. So as far as the particular prosecutor, without actually saying it, they're exposing themselves. Because when the prosecutor made his little patriotic speech, there was evidence that there was a videotape and that the National Security Advisor had it. So the first thing the prosecutor should have said, and, you know, I'm talking about if prosecutors weren't what they are, prosecutors, is let me see the videotape. That way we can know if we actually have a case against Jackson or not. But they never, the prosecutor never even mentions the videotape in the movie. Thereby has an element of plausible deniability, even though there's records that they actually videotaped the whole process. So, you know, meaning that they have video cameras at the U.S. Embassy in Yemen. But now, let's go further back into the real world. And here, the pro-torture Gonzalez, at a Senate hearing, go over some questions by Senator Leahy asking about what he does accept concerning responsibilities for what has taken place concerning torture in Iraq. So let's see what this Gonzalez has to say. Check it out.
Connection whatsoever between the policies which actually you have to formulate regarding the treatment and interrogation of prisoners, policies that were sent out, Department of Defense and elsewhere, and the widespread abuses that have occurred. College, any accountability for such things, any connection?
Senator, as I said in my remarks, I categorically condemn the conduct that we see reflected in these pictures at Abu Ghraib. I would refer you to the 8 completed investigations of what happened at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, and there are still 3 ongoing. I'll talk about the Tagaboo report, the Faye Jones Kerr report, the Schlesinger report, the Navy IG, the Army IG, Jacoby, Ryder, Miller, all of these reports. And if you listen to the press briefings given in connection with the rollout of these reports, they do conclude that with respect to the conduct, not reflected in the photos, not the conduct that we find the most offensive, but conduct related to pure interrogations, that there was some confusion.
The same reports you talk about say the DOD, Department of Defense relied on the memo. It was quoted extensively in the DOD working group report on interrogation. That report has never been repudiated. So apparently they did rely on their memo, and when we find out about the abuses, we never find out from the administration. We find out because the press reports it. Is there any accountability here anywhere? As I mentioned earlier, my son was in the military. He was held to very, very strict standard. He trained for combat, held to very, very strict standard. The vast majority of the men and women in the military held those same strict standards. I'm just trying to find out where the accountability is for this terrible blot. You and I both agree, it's a terrible blot on the United States.
I believe that is a very good question, Senator, and that is why we have these 8 complete investigations, these 3 pending investigations, and while we've had 4 hearings involving the Secretary of Defense, we've had 18 hearings involving the Deputy Secretary, Undersecretary of Defense, you've had over 40 briefings with the Congress, because we care very much about finding out what happened and holding people accountable. Unlike other countries that talk about Geneva, if there is an allegation that we've done something wrong, we investigate it. We're very serious about our commitments, our legal obligations in Iraq. And if people have done things that they shouldn't have done in violation of our legal obligations, they are going to be held accountable.
See, that shows you how sick and cynical these guys are in the real world. They just blew up damn near Fallujah. Homes were flooded and caught on fire. They gutted through the whole damn city in a very cynical act, even though they admitted that most of the insurgents who they claimed that they were after were gone. And he's up here talking about they take serious. Right now, they're breaking even international and UN law using depleted uranium in Iraq, which is considered a weapon of mass destruction. That is basically going to be in the soil, in the water of Iraq indefinitely. These fools don't take serious any kind of international law or anything concerning humanity. This rhetoric about holding something accountable, we hold people accountable and all of that type of stuff. Boy George lied all the way through the bank with the whole weapons of mass destruction. Was he held accountable? The uranium story. Was he held accountable? Colin Powell lying at the UN. Was he held accountable? They ended up plagiarizing the stories in the UN that Colin Cancer Powell used from basically written stuff that a student had written, you know, years ago. Was anyone held accountable? The only accountability that they align themselves with is those who pledge allegiance to the empire. The only real human accountability that's ever going to take place is when we hold them accountability, hold them accountable, basically by taking off their heads. Right now, they're flipping the script on the whole Bin Laden. You know, on January 9th, just when you think you've heard it all, another thing has come out by many of these rewriters of history and strategizers for the empire. Quote, "The world may be better off if Osama bin Laden remains at large, according to the Central Intelligence Agency recently departed executive director. If the world's most wanted terrorist is captured or killed, a power struggle among his Al-Qaeda subordinates may trigger a wave of terror attacks," said A.B. Buzzy Krongard, who stepped down 6 weeks ago as the CIA's 3rd most senior executive. Quote, "You can make the argument that we're better off with him at large," Krongard said, "because if something happens to bin Laden, you might find a lot of people vibing for his position and demonstrating how macho they are by unleashing a stream of terror," unquote. So here are these clowns in the midst of their so-called war on terror, now basically saying, keep Bin Laden at large. Now, this, of course, is to keep the whole boogeyman thing going on indefinitely and stuff. But they're trying to spin it. They're trying to spin it like the world's safer off with the number one so-called terrorist at large. This is how cynical, hypocritical, and wretched these dogs are. But to go into how also wretched these clowns are in the real world, here's Mark Danner. He's the author of the book Torture and Truth that just came out. He's a longtime writer and critic on a lot of these types of issues. And he also responds to some of Gonzalez's rhetoric that you just heard. So let's see what Mark Danner has to say. Check it out.
That was a remarkable moment in the hearing, because as Alberto Gonzalez did many times during the day, he referred to documents as supporting his position, which in fact, if you read them, completely undermine his position. He did it with a confidence that the public will not read these documents. You know, one of the reasons I published all of these documents in Torture and Truth is because I have the hope, as Izzy Stone did as well, that people, the public, will pick these things up and read them. Because if, you know, Alberto Gonzalez cited what he called the Tagubu Report, the Taguba Report, put out by a major general in the army, which points to these so-called abuses and says plainly that they're systemic. That is, the notion that these are, you know, just the doings of some frat boy-like soldiers on the night shift, animal house on the night shift, as James R. Schlesinger said, is completely disproved by the reports that were commissioned to investigate it. And when he cited all of these reports, they in fact undermine his position. You know, he had confidence not only that the public wouldn't read these things, but that the senators in front of him would not read them, or at least would not contradict him. And I think it's an important, very important right now to point out, Jennifer Harbury pointed out the awful things that the U.S. government did in Central America and has done in the past, most notably to her husband, and I salute what she's done in bringing these things to the public, and her courage in her approach to what the U.S. government has done in the past. But I'd also like to point out a distinction, which is that in the case of Iraq, Guantanamo, Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, and other secret prisons that we don't know anything about, these things are the result of stated policy within the government, policies that we now know about, that we can read about in the documents, and that have been accepted throughout the bureaucracy. The United States has, since 9/11, gone officially from a country that at least officially does not torture to one that does. And, you know, these things have elicited an enormous debate within the bureaucracy. Many of the documents that I published in Torture and Truth are now available to the public because people within the government, angry about these policies, leaked them. And this includes especially a number of military officers. You can see the debates, if you read the documents, you can see the debates that happened within the government, where you had people objecting strenuously to the adoption of these policies. And it is no longer a matter of controversy, not only what was done, that is, you had interrogators, it was a matter of policy torturing prisoners, not people simply going beyond the bounds of what was allowed, people who did the things that were allowed, and also that you had bureaucrats like Mr. Gonzalez, appointed officials, who decided on these policies, who debated them, and who then handed down the guidelines that they produced within the Department of Justice, within the Department of Defense, by high defense officials, were handed down to military officers and intelligence officers on the ground, who then took these policy guidelines and tortured people. And despite Mr. Gonzalez's obfuscations, which I think were rather outrageous, I was prepared for them to deny some of these things, but I think in the blatantness with which he contradicted what we know, public evidence on the record, I think it was quite outrageous, his performance. it is a fact that these things happen. It is a fact that documents that he was responsible for drafting or soliciting, particularly the famous torture memo from the Department of Justice, which then became a part of the Department of Defense working group guideline on interrogation, it is a fact that these things then came down and were made policy and resulted in the suffering of people.
Right? Now, once again, what Danner was outlining was the whole cynicalness. This is why, like, I don't cut the Democrats any slack on this. As it was outlined, Gonzalez was referring to documents in front of the Senate, like they support his position, even though they undermine his position and exposed him as an illegal, immoral, barbaric torturer who drafted an important essence of the whole torture memo. But he did it with full confidence that he would not be contradicted or challenged by the Senate, Democrat or Republican, or the corporate media system. This is how it works in the real world. Now, as Danner himself wrote in his book, Torture and Truth, he outlines this one thing where it goes, quote, certain coalition forces and military intelligence officers told the ICRC that in their estimate, between 70% and 90% of the persons deprived of their liberty in Iraq had been arrested by mistake. Now, these were the people who were grabbed and thrown into all of this Abu Ghraib stuff. So the overwhelming majority of the people that they ended up torturing didn't even have anything to do with the insurgents. This is this massive, insidious barbarity towards the population as a whole. This is this goes into down in the annals of how basically the whole collective guilt structuring and mindset has historically been placed on black people. Find a Negro, any Negro, lynch a Negro. We've seen this pattern before from these beasts, and we're seeing it again.
Yeah, and you know what? The cynicism thing and the denial thing here on the two issues that Tracy earlier played. Number one, Gonzalez on the torture. Everybody knows that this pig, this little punk, wrote some stuff out about how it was okay to torture people. And he wrote a legal justification for torture. That's what he did. Okay? Now, then you hear this charlatan, this sophist from the CIA, hollering about maybe it's a good thing we ain't caught him. We ain't caught Osama bin Laden. This denial is part of the program of the Republican Party. They deny any form and any and all mistakes, bad judgment. They deny corruption, relying on spin, not truth, and thereby building a solid reputation for mendacity and incompetence. They deny the limitations of military power to impose order in a recalcitrant world, and thereby condemn the United States to a future of international isolation, conflict, and endless terrorism. So they had people out there looking for weapons of mass destruction. I'm not making a joke about this. It's kind of sad, but they had people out there actually looking for him. They had people out there looking for Osama. No, there you go over there. Going around here. Probably harassing some people in little small villages, minding their damn business, trying to eke out a living. And here comes Sam. I know you know where he is. Tell me, probably torturing them. Tell me where Osama is. Now they're going to tell you, don't really matter no way. It don't really matter no way. You know, this is sick. The last burp from a sick society.
Now next, back to Hollywood land. And here you see a military family. Basically, Tommy Lee Jones, Tom's father, and Tommy Lee Jones' son at kind of a little picnic family discussion, discussing this case that he's going to take on for Jackson. So let's check out how this built.
Friend, good to see you. You'll be what, sir?
You served with him. Is he the rabid dog we've all been hearing about?
I don't think I should comment, sir.
Come on, Dad, this is family. Enlighten us just a little bit.
You know, we said at the Naval Academy, even if you thought you weren't responsible, it went wrong, and you were there.
Since when have you not had a comment?
These children asked me to defend him.
Are you kidding me?
No.
Why would you do that?
Because he asked me, and I owe him.
Well, that's great. That represents everything that's wrong with the military.
Wisdom from the one person who's survived is not elected to serve his country. And the children must have snapped. That was a comment. I've seen it many times.
I'd like to thank you all for reminding me why we have the presumption of innocence in the United States of America.
What are you, Abraham Lincoln? Come on, you can't hide behind that. The guy murdered innocent women and children.
Where'd you hear that, on television?
Yeah, hey, come on, boy. It's mom and dad's anniversary.
Don't take this case, son. This man has trashed the reputation of the court. It's put us back 20 years.
I don't see how I can turn him down. He saved my life.
Well, I understand that as well as anyone. But you don't repay him by falling senselessly on a grenade. The way I see it, this man should find himself the best damn lawyer in the country.
Somebody better than me. The guy's a real Marine, Dad. I mean, if they can do this to him, just hang him out to dry, they can do it to anybody. Forget that he's my friend. You can do it to anybody. And that means that your medals and your citations won't mean jack shit when they come after you.
I think
so once again, you see this whole thing take place where even this military family, which are traditionally very conservative, are cynical. You know, of Jackson. So Jackson's just let out, you know, they're cynical of their own military guys. They, unlike in how it often works in the real world, where they're doing all this bombastic talk about the so-called liberal media and things of that nature, the father of Tommy Lee Jones's character, for wanting to take on the case, he's presented as an Abraham Lincoln character. You know, like, you know, like, what do you have a noble heart? You know, what are you doing taking on this case? All that type of stuff. Tommy Lee Jones' own father just thinks that Childress must have snapped, and then blames Childress, you know, the Jackson character, for putting the military back 20 years. 20 years? With all of the tiger force and barbarity that the U.S. Empire has been engaged in consistently, this one little thing is now suddenly supposed to be the ultimate bad mark on the U.S. military. For all the barbarity that they're doing currently and have done in the past, this incident, see, this is Hollywood world, where they present, you know, a few years back, when these people came out with a story, it was like on CNN or one of those networks, but they had done a lot of investigation and actually came out with a story about how the U.S. Military used a particular gas, like some DX-type gas, on its own military forces. And what happened? The military consolidated its forces. They got colon cancer power and all of these little higher-ups. And they came out and started to attack the case and attack the people associated with doing the journalism on the case. It turns out that all of the journalism was sound, but they still were able they still managed to Gary Webb, the producers of that particular case, right out of their position. They ended up being crucified, fired, and stuff. So here you have a case in this Hollywood version where the evidence, going by their rules of engagement construct, is on Samuel Jackson's side. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, the whole fact that the U.S. is an imperial killing machine, it's over in someone else's land, da-da-da-da-da. I'm talking about within the construct of even the particular laws that they claim that they follow. Jackson was shielded by those laws. But, no, the whole military and the whole apparatus turns against them and leave him out to be the sacrificial lamb. And what's kind of cynical is that when they had this machine gunning of all of these Arabs, the person who gave the command, i.e. Samuel Jackson, and the person who was second in charge and had his troops follow through with the command, Blair Underwood, are both little Negroes. So they had these two guys, these two little Negroes, playing the role of the lead assassins for the military, you know, showing their little Negro faces, being all patriotic to the cause, but also to kind of gloss over what historically has been in many of these types of barbaric acts by the U.S. military, a racial undertone beneath all this stuff. Once again, a sly ploy by these Hollywood writers and producers in the way they structured this whole thing.
Oh, yeah. And you know something? This is the head-fixing industry. That's why we call it that. Call things by their right names. Now look, check this. So you notice the ultra-decent military family. The little kid. Oh, no, no, him murderer daddy, him murderer daddy. Oh, they done raised them all right. Everybody love humanity. Man, get the hell away from here. If you know anything about the reality in these families, do you think people are stupid? Do you think people don't know what you do when you're in the military? What do they think people do? We just go and fly around and wave at people. Hey, how y'all doing? Go meet the girls. Yeah, the military, yeah. Military, kill people. What the hell wrong with you? But no. That deep, no. We not my military. We not kill no innocent people. Listen, there's no such modern warfare. There was a time, 500 years ago, oh, 200 years ago, where one army would meet the other. And then you would have a series of clashes. And basically, the armies would combat each other. And whichever army won, won the fight. But with the advent of World War I, that was the end of that. That was long gone. No longer is warfare a matter of fighting between armies and the civilians, citizens. They just stay out of it. No. The more bodies you pile up, the surer it is you will win. What the hell you think? You think a bomb has eyes? It comes, oh, wait a minute, that's a civilian. Let me turn around over here. And, oh, no, that's a baby. No, I'm not going to kill no. Wait a minute. Oh, no, that's a church right there. Don't want to hit a church. Oops, school there. Hold on. Oh, there's the munitions factory. Boom. Believe that if you want to. But let me tell you something. Modern warfare is by its very nature genocidal. There are no good guys. Do you hear me? When you got to throw down in this context today, any modern war is going to lead to the mass slaughter of civilians. That's why we say to the United States, get the hell out of Iraq. That's why we side with the insurgents. No, I'm not Islamic. I'm an atheist, don't believe none of that religious bullshit. But I know there's such a thing as right and wrong. And the United States invaded those people's country. And, you know, just the idea that Americans are so stupid, you inside somebody else's country and you don't know that there's going to be a problem? Come on, please, man, tell us anything. One more point. And that is the one true... No, I'm sorry. Two more. The one true thing that you saw, you know, is this in the movie that does, that is real. And that's the turning of the so-called military people on scapegoats. That is one thing they've got working in this society, working like a max. They will turn on you in a New York second if they think they're going to get a little, you know, you suppose, oh, you did so, oh, yeah. Don't know none of the facts. They done all turned on him already. You see? Now, that's real. That is white folks in the military. They do that kind of shit. Then the other thing, and this is just a point on the truth in the military. Let's face it now, once again, on the head-fixing industry. Just what Tracy just said. When old colon cancer Powell go in there and attacked the people who were exposing a war crime, right? Well, you know what? Just recently, CBS fired four journalists. For what? They claim they fired them for sloppy journalistic measures. They didn't go and follow and find out where the Xerox originally came from, and therefore this is shoddy journalism. No. They got rid of those people for a very specific reason. Because the CBS 60 Minutes report was exposing that crackhead president of yours for running off and going AWOL when he was supposed to come in and take a physical, which included the drug test, okay? That's what happened. No one denies it. Everybody knows it's true. But they can't. You can't say it. You know why? Because you can't prove it. You know why? Because we went back for the records, and they're gone. So here you have a situation where four people have been fired for attacking the president's military record, where everybody knows it's true. Nobody that has attacked these people, or the reason they got fired, no one has argued that the contention that George Bush went AWOL was false. But they say they didn't get the right Xerox, and therefore, they're bad journalists. You go figure. Come on, Trey.
Now, next, let's hear right from the rat's mouth on torture and Gonzalez and other things. This is taken up on a panel discussion on none other than Fox News. Now, this isn't their more rabid particular show. This one has Juan Williams, the pseudo-liberal, and, you know, then like three or four other kooks and stuff. But it's not like Hannity and Cohn. But, well, at the end of the day, then again, it is. Check it out.
The exchange between Lindsey Graham and Alberto Gonzalez was the most important, an extremely important debate. Number one, do you really gain anything? Is rough treatment necessary in the war on terror? Is it really getting us more information, more intelligence? We don't know that. And at what cost? This is an ideological war, just like the Cold War. It's democracy and human rights versus political Islam, or whatever we want to call Islamic fundamentalism that leads to terror. And in that war, the America has to stand for something. And if it doesn't look like it stands for something, if it's willing to compromise all those ideals, I think it hurts.
Are you talking to me? Is there anything in all of this that suggested that all of these ideals are being compromised?
No, but the images that Abugrade, memos that suggest we're trying to define the definition of torture in a very narrow way, hurt us. And that's the point that Lindsey Graham and other military lawyers, retired and active, were making.
Look, it's really easy to demagogue this idea and speak about torture and memos. Look, if you do rough stuff on prisoners, obviously it is an injury to our ideals, and it could be an injury also to our image. However, all of us can imagine a case in which there's a nuclear weapon in New York City. Somebody knows where it is. It's going to go off in an hour. And the question is, are you not going to use rough stuff? Only a moral idiot would say that you don't use rough stuff. You use anything that you could. So there's always an extreme at which you are going to use almost any rough stuff. And the question that serious people have to ask is, what are the circumstances under which you use rough stuff, and how rough can you be? To stand up and say, I'm against all torture, all abuse, is easy and cheap and worthless.
But what about the practices that we know to have occurred? I mean, from Abu Ghraib to what's going on at Guantanamo. And what about the one thing that Gonzalez did say, although he pledged anew to resist violations of U.S. law, violations of Geneva Conventions, he also made the argument that the Geneva Conventions, which are a treaty, do not apply to terrorists operating like Al-Qaeda. It's less clear what he meant with regard to terrorists operating now inside Iraq. But what about that issue?
Well, that's true. On the other hand, of course, Abu Ghraib was not an instance of terrorists, and it was just an instance of misconduct. I guess, look, I'm not so worried about our image in the Muslim world. You know, we they're not so sensitive, and they're not going to, you know, recoil in horror if we do, if a few soldiers do things they shouldn't do, and they shouldn't do. I'm more worried about the effect it has on us and our soldiers, actually. I don't really like we do have a uniform code of military justice, and we don't want to be routine. I mean, it's one thing to do things in extremis, as Charles says. If everyone agrees, if there's a nuclear bomb about to go off, or perhaps there's one high-quality, high-value guy who's captured, we think he knows about imminent terrorist attacks. But clearly what happened at Guantanamo, what happened at Abu Ghraib, was beyond that. There was a breakdown in military discipline. It's bad for America, for Americans to be doing those
things. Yeah, what it says about us, I agree with Bill completely, what it says about us and what it says to our soldiers, to our people who are executing American policy, is the key here, less so than what it says to anyone in the world. But I think that what Charles did was bring up an extreme case about, you know, the idea of like a 24 nuclear bomb in New York City. That has nothing to do with behavior, what took place with wrapping people in the Israeli flag, putting them in frozen rooms, blaring music in their ears.
Was that torture in your view?
Well, it was humiliation. It was humiliation, I might add, the Israeli flag and the sexual thing with the female soldiers rubbing genitals and all the rest. You know, that was intended, I think, specifically to insult Muslim people. Yeah, that's really awful, Charles, if you stop and think about it.
If it's documented that those practices actually have been proved to give us better intelligence, I'd like to see that.
You talk about it. If it is, what would we do?
Well, I think that would open up a whole new range of debate. But
open up a whole new range of debate. See, this is why, in the end, what has to happen in America and other places around the world is, in a sense, everyone has to be held accountable. You know, you just can't be a talking head, then go off to your little Pentagon, go off to your little penthouse suite. You know, the O'Reillys of the world have to get smacked. They got to get gatted. You know, they can't just be allowed to be talking points and talking heads for the U.S. Empire's geopolitical imperial policies and stuff. And then just, you know, go off to Gold's Gym, do their little work off, and then work out, and then go home and stuff. That's not acceptable. These guys got to end up in coffins, too, because they're helping legitimize this whole barbaric world action the same way that these little writers, Hollywood myth-making producers and creators of these movies, they do the same thing to us when they basically negrofy us, you know, in these stereotypical roles and all of that through Hollywood. And you can see what they're doing clearly on the international level. Now, this is just part one of a two-part thing on rules of propaganda, i.e. rules of engagement movie. We're going to have to finish it up next week. So hold on.
Well, that the agency has tremendous relations with the established media. I think somewhere else it goes on to list all of the various organizations, the television news, the magazines, the newspapers, even Hollywood studios has very close relations with all of these organizations, including, of course, academia. And it uses those relationships to color stories to favor the CIA. I say color, it can be from just changing them from one view to another, just changing the slant a bit, or however minimally changing the story. It's been doing that, of course, since it was created in 47. One of the things that I discovered in my career in the agency was that the agency uses its intelligence frequently as a disinformation mechanism for deceiving, I wouldn't say deceiving, but putting forth the correct policy line. If it's involved in creating a war in Vietnam or creating a covert operation in Vietnam, then all of its intelligence lines up to support that war. And in that particular case, not only was the intelligence created to form a fantasy of, essentially a fantasy of what was going on, but the agency had a rather massive domestic operation to draw the United States into the war, and when things started going bad, to keep us in the war. One of the master propaganda operations was the sponsorship of Dr. Dooley. I don't know if you recall Dr. Tom Dooley, who was a hero of Vietnam, and he was equated with Dr. Albert Schweitzer and just with the top heroes of our age, and he gave, I guess, hundreds if not thousands of lectures in the United States. He wrote three books that all propagandized for the war, or essentially lied about the war, but propagandized for the war, and appeared in Time and Life and just all over the American domestic media. And if you were a student in a Catholic school in those days, you brought your pennies in to contribute to the Dr. Dooley's good work in Southeast Asia. So that, I think, that was one of the master disinformation programs, as long as well as with its intelligence. The Public Affairs Office is designed to keep in contact with members of the media and with academia and with people making inquiries about the agency. And it becomes sort of a tight relationship between the CIA and various elements of the media. And we have a document. The document was released under the Freedom of Information Act that said that in the year of 1991, the PAO, the Public Affairs Books, Public Affairs Office, responded to 3,369 queries in 1991. And then it provided background briefings to a number of journalists, 174 in 1991. And it arranged interviews with the director and the deputy director, 164 and 91. And the PAO responds to numerous requests from authors, researchers, filmmakers, and others seeking guidance or cooperation, such as Life Magazine's proposed photo essay, BBC's six-part series, and it just goes on and on. That's BBB's six-part series. I was involved with that. The producer came to my out to my house a number of times and was very debriefed me and wanted me to go to Vietnam, and he was very sympathetic to what I was saying.
That's going to just about wrap it up, Slade, tonight. It's clear that with the propaganda through the corporate media to Hollywood, that you're going to have to fight for your mind. Until the next time, Slave Revolt. Out.
gotta fight, fight, fight for your mind. Why you got the time? You got to fight, fight, fight for your mind. Take a stand. Said you gotta fight, fight, fight for your mind. You got to fight for your mind. Why you got time? You got to fight.